On the first anniversary of the U.S. assassination of Iranian commander General Qasem Soleimani and his companions, Palestinians in the Gaza Strip came together to thank the general for his support in their struggle against the Israeli aggression.
The assassination of General Soleimani has not stopped Iran's support for the Palestinian cause. Our resistance will continue until the liberation of Al-Quds. The blood of General Soleimani will not go in vain. General Soleimani made a turning point in the history of the Palestinian cause.
Many Palestinian leaders and officials joined the mourners and expressed gratitude to Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani, who was assassinated in a U.S. airstrike in Baghdad on January. Palestinians consider General Soleimani a symbol of resistance for all the oppressed Palestinians.
We stress that the resistance will continue till all Zionist plots are thwarted in the region. The path of General Soleimani will continue. His assassination has made us more determined to keep the resistance alive.
Palestinians stress that they will follow in the footsteps of General Soleimani, who had a major role in supporting the Palestinian resistance in different fields and making a big difference in the balance of deterrence and rules with the Zionist regime.
General Soleimani was assassinated because he was supporting the resistance front. He always cared about Jerusalem, Al-Quds, and Palestinians. His assassination has made us more united in our fight against the occupation.
Similar gatherings were held in other parts of the region to commemorate the Iranian top commander.
Palestinians here consider General Soleimani a symbol of resistance. They say they will continue his path of struggling against the Israeli occupation until the liberation of Palestine and Jerusalem al-Quds. Ruba Shabet, Gaza.
New crimes are added to the Saudi-led coalition's record violations of international law following the death of 22 Yemeni prisoners and the coalition's prisons in 2020, all due to torture and medical neglect.
Torture has become a regular thing for the Saudi coalition, and unfortunately, these crimes are being frequent and vary from year to year. This year, 22 prisoners were killed either under torture or medical and food neglect. So we believe that there is an intention to get rid of the prisoners.
The head of Yemen's National Committee for Prisoners Affairs confirms that the UAE keeps hundreds of prisoners in its presence in southern Yemen, despite its refusal to attend any negotiations, while the United Nations has promised to attend amid the humanitarian nature of the prisoners' issue.
The Emiratis are an essential part of this aggression, and they are on the ground and they have dozens of prisons in the lands they occupied here and in the Horn of Africa. We have asked the United Nations to bring the Emiratis for negotiations, but so far there is no response from them and we are still waiting.
2020 witnessed remarkable progress in the liberation of 1,087 prisoners of the Yemeni army and the popular committees, 670 of whom were freed through UN mediation and the rest through local exchange deals.
The Saudi coalition's violations of international humanitarian laws are not only against the prisoners, but against the entire people of Yemen, who are the victims of an ongoing war on their country. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Tehran University has held a ceremony to mark the anniversary of the U.S. assassination of Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani. Iran's Minister of Science and Technology, who was attending the ceremony, said that universities and academic centers have great capacities to keep the path of Qasem Soleimani alive by studying different aspects of his personality and beliefs.
General Qasem Soleimani was a great person. His personality had different aspects. I believe that academic centers should study his behaviors and personality. I think his lifestyle and beliefs serve as a good role model for all the youth of our country and the world. We have great capacities and potentials at universities and academic centers in this regard.
The event in Tehran came as people and officials attended a ceremony in the city of Kerman, the burial place of General Qasem Soleimani, to remember his lofty status 1 year after his martyrdom.
The martyrdom of General Qasem Soleimani had a big impact on the minds of people, both because of his own personality and what happened after his martyrdom. Therefore, for a researcher and expert of social sciences, his martyrdom provides a wide range of topics to study.
General Soleimani, the commander of the Quds Force of the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps, IRGC, and his trench mate Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis were assassinated along with their companions in a U.S. terror drone strike near Baghdad International Airport on January 3, 2020. Meanwhile, in response, the IRGC targeted the U.S. airbase of Ain al-Assad in Anbar province in western Iraq to retaliate the U.S. assassination of top Iranian anti-terror commander Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani. Moreover, according to Iranian officials, Tehran has filed a lawsuit against the U.S. for assassinating General Soleimani, and soon a court session will be held in Iran in this regard. Iranian officials believe that more than anything, the U.S. assassination of General Qasem Soleimani has proved to the global public opinion that the U.S. administration is the leading sponsor of terrorism in the world. Saman Kujuri, Tehran.
In gratitude for their sacrifices in confronting America, Israel and the Houthis in the region, Yemenis held an event to commemorate the first anniversary of the martyrdom of Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani and his companion Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis in the presence of the Iranian ambassador and representatives of the Islamic Resistance Movement.
Today, we live on the martyrdom anniversary of the two leaders, Soleimani and al-Muhandis. Remember the positions of these two heroes to stand by the nation's causes. Haj Qasem Soleimani gave himself to Palestine and the resistance, and was intransigent in front of the projects of the Zionist enemy, through which it wants to break up the region.
The participants recalled the actions of the martyr Soleimani and how he terrified America and Israel, which thought by assassinating him to weaken the resistance forces, but contrary, it lit a fire that would not be extinguished until the liberation of Jerusalem al-Quds and the demise of global arrogance.
We commemorate the two great martyrs, Haj Qasem Soleimani and Abu Mahdi Muhandis, who strived for God's cause and are loyal to God and did what they were required to do. God gave them wisdom and strength. They were great people, and we should follow their path.
The martyr Soleimani was an icon in the face of the Zionist entity and its projects. He played a great role in supporting the Palestinian resistance movement and stood by the Iraqi Popular Mobilization Forces in its battles with Daesh in Iraq. Once again, Yemenis have taken a resolve to continue the legacy of General Qasem Soleimani in the face of years of aggression against the impoverished nation by Saudi Arabia and some of its regional allies and their Western backers. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
People have gathered here in Kabul to pay respect to the bravery and the leading role of two significant figures against invading forces and foreign-backed terrorists, Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani and Afghanistan's national hero, Ahmad Shah Massoud.
Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani and our national hero, Ahmad Shah Massoud, were close friends and comrades in the region. Their sacrifices have not been fully highlighted yet, so we need to know them more than ever.
Given the fact that Afghanistan has been repeatedly invaded by some superpowers, mainly over the past two centuries, resistance is considered a familiar concept among the nation. Afghans have had some top resistance leaders like Ahmad Shah Massoud, a national hero who became the victim of a terrorist attack back in 2001. His characteristics are very much similar to that of Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani in the eyes of Afghans.
The U.S. expected to remove the name of Qasem Soleimani from the minds of resisting nations by assassinating him. But contrary to those expectations, he became a popular hero, not only for Iranians, but also for all resistance nations across the world, just like Massoud.
Afghans and Iranians share many commonalities in terms of history, culture, religion, and security.
Many people here in Afghanistan believe that one of the major similarities between these two nations is their resisting spirit against the invaders. This event in Afghanistan marks the memories of two well-known resistance leaders, Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani and Afghanistan's national hero Ahmad Shah Massoud. This comes as Afghans themselves are suffering from terrorism and are seeking to follow the path of these two heroes. Syed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
This is IRIB English Radio.
Get up. Good morning.
Good morning. Your captain speaking, and we are currently cruising over Iranian skies.
گاه شهید بهشتی مسافرین گرامی خواهش مند از جهت تعیین مسیر به تابلوهای راهنما توجه فرمایید.
Hello, good morning.
Good morning. How is everything?
Good morning, all.
Good morning.
Good morning. Good morning.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Supplication on Thursdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who has taken away the shadowy night by His power and brought the sight-giving day through His mercy. He has clothed me in its brightness and given me its favor. O Allah, just as Thou hast spared me for this day, so also spare me for its likes. Bless the Prophet Muhammad and his household, and torment me not in it and in other nights and days by allowing me to commit unlawful acts and to clothe myself in sins. Provide me with its good, the good of all within it, and the good of everything after it, and turn away from me its evil, the evil of all within it, and the evil of everything after it. O Allah, By the protective compact of Islam, I seek mediation with thee. And by the inviolability of the Quran, I rely upon thee. By Muhammad, the chosen, Allah bless him and his household, I seek intercession with thee. So recognize my protective compact, by which I hope my need will be granted. O most merciful of the merciful, O Allah, decree for me on Thursday five things, which none embraces but thy generosity, and none supports but thy favors. Health through which I may have the strength to obey thee. Worship by which I may deserve thy plentiful reward. Plenty in my state through lawful provision. And that thou makest me secure in the places of fear through thy security. And placest me in thy fortress against the striking of worries and sorrows. Bless Muhammad and his household. And make my seeking his mediation as an intercessor give profits on the day of resurrection. Surely, thou art the most merciful of the merciful.
The debate.
Hello and everyone, welcome to the debate. I'm Behrouz Najafi. An affront to justice. That's how the UN has described President Trump's recent pardons for Blackwater mercenaries. Rights experts complain that a pardon for the four security contractors convicted of killing Iraqi civilians in 2007 undermines humanitarian law. UN experts have reminded the fact that based on the Geneva Convention, war criminals must be held accountable for their crimes even when acting as private security contractors. That's the topic of our debate show tonight. Stay with us for that. Now let's go to Washington, D.C. to our own correspondent, Dr. Colin Campbell. Colin, last week we were discussing the same issue from a different angle, and there was media blackout. The majority of mainstream U.S. media didn't mention this. So now the UN has taken it to a different level. It's now some kind of legal challenge. What about now?
That's right, and it looks like the media has picked up on it a little bit, really expressing outrage from some of the commentators that have remarked about the pardons that the president made for these contractors from Blackwater. As we understand, this was an egregious crime that was committed with the slaughter of innocent Iraqi civilians that were later the perpetrators of this crime now can walk free. So you have some media outlets, if they aren't just saying and stating what happened as a declarative, they're expressing outrage, anger, and just disbelief that these would be the people that the president has pardoned. Now, what is being looked at also is just the whole pardoning process. I think that the president has put a test on the whole system of who is pardoned and why. Usually it is for people who were not afforded equity in under the eyes of the law. Maybe there was a law that was misapplied, or maybe something that was done unjudiciously, or something that was done a little bit too exacting or too draconian in method. Well, this time it seems that this was the president's privilege that he took to pardon people that he felt should be pardoned, or people who were giving deference to the president. Mm-hmm. And I think that's why there are many people who are now questioning just the whole system of who is pardoned. Again, this is not the main story that is coming from U.S. media, but it is something that is being discussed, especially amongst those who are at liberty to discuss the topics of the day with a little bit more freedom in their rhetoric rather than just stating the news of the day as a flat declarative.
Okay, thank you, Doc. Our own Colin Campbell in Washington, D.C. Now, joining me to discuss this a little bit and look at it from different angles, first will be former independent expert with the UN Human Rights Council, Alfred Desires, out of Geneva. Good to have you with us, Alfred. Welcome to the show. And, these security contractors took the lives of Iraqi civilians back in 2007. On what ground has President Trump pardoned them?
Well, we have a culture of impunity in the United States, and this is only one of many cases. Constitutionally, the president does have the authority to pardon criminals, except that in this case, basically, he's giving his blessing on murder, his blessing on a massive war crime. But it's not just the practice of granting pardons. Is also the consistent pattern of impunity for American soldiers who commit crimes and for private security companies whose members, and we had nearly 100,000 private security officials in Iraq at the time, and there were many other major crimes committed. It's not just this one in Nusra Square in 2007. I remember the crimes committed at the time of the rape of Fallujah, and we know the crimes committed in Guantanamo as a daily torture situation that has been repeatedly condemned by United Nations rapporteurs. And all of these persons involved in these crimes have enjoyed and continue enjoying impunity. As an American, I can say not in my name. I mean, I find it egregious, I find it outrageous. But as Campbell just said, the mainstream media doesn't like to carry these stories. I recall when I was a young student at Harvard, that was during the Vietnam War, and there were all of these war crimes committed by American soldiers against the Vietnamese people, civilians, women, children. Very little made it to the press, and it was us, the activists, the students, who were protesting because we had heard about these things and we wanted to see accountability on the part of American soldiers. Who was tried? This insignificant Lieutenant William Calley, instead of trying General Maxwell Taylor, instead of holding the hires up accountable for the systematic crimes being committed in Vietnam, and for decades now, since the beginning of the so-called war on terror, we've had a problem of so-called secret prisons, the problem of extraordinary renditions. And my colleague and rapporteur on human rights while combating terrorism, Ben Emerson, did a study on extraordinary renditions, and it turned out that 54 countries in the world participated in the extraordinary renditions, and countries like Poland, Romania, Egypt, etc., all participated in this completely illegal program of kidnapping and sending people to be tortured. I mean, we had special agreements with Egypt, and we sent people specifically to be tortured in Egypt. Wow. And of course, we continued the torture in Guantanamo, and as I said, in total impunity, because no one has ever been held accountable.
Okay. Now let me also invite Senior Ellis with Foreign Policy and Focus, Ian Williams, out of New York. Good to have you with us, sir. And rights groups argue that allowing private security firms like Blackwater to operate with impunity in armed conflicts will embolden the states to circumvent their obligations under humanitarian law. Is that true?
Yes, quite clearly. I was present at the first, the negotiations that led to the signing of the UN, of the International Criminal Court. Mm-hmm. And I spoke to a lot of the State Department and U.S. military analysts and lawyers who were involved. And their sincere thesis was that because the law only allowed for prosecution if the state concerned had failed, then it was okay. You know, Americans were protected because they said, we have the best military justice system in the world. I had memories of Milei, like our other interlocutor there, where you might remember it took something like 30 years for the pilot of the helicopter that stopped the massacre to be recognized by Bill Clinton. But Bill Clinton was the president at the time and was at least paying lip service when the treaty was signed. We know that the U.S. couldn't ratify it because of Republican opposition. And it's on the basic same principle. The U.S. can never do any wrong. I mean, it's American exceptionalism to the max. First of all, the U.S. can do no wrong. And secondly, that anyone wearing a uniform must be supported, which we're seeing with police impunity, with military impunity. He shot somebody in full daylight who was unarmed, but he's a policeman doing his duty, so we must support him. It's that attitude that pervades the whole system. And it really has come out here because these people were, they were paid security guards. They were like the doorman in a nightclub. I mean, it's like giving the bouncer in a nightclub the option to kill people at will. And internationally, that's how it will be seen. This was a clear massacre. Not the only one, by the way. They haven't even tried to investigate the massacre in the square that WikiLeaks revealed, where a helicopter up in the air gunned down a Reuters camera crew and then gunned down the people who went to rescue them and give them medical aid. That hasn't even been investigated yet, let alone prosecuted. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, this is a whole level of impunity which needs examination. Of course, we know, in fact, that the people who leaked that, they are being persecuted by the government, but not the people who kept it secret, who did it, who ordered it, who provided the circumstances, empowered those people to go in and kill civilians. And it's bad for the U.S. in every way, not just morally, but if you're going to be cynical, it means that their word is worth nothing when it comes to looking for war criminals abroad. Who would hand over somebody to the United States as a suspected war criminal, knowing the United States' partial record, where they protect the guilty when it's theirs and persecute the innocent when they're foreigners?
Okay. Now back to Geneva. Alfred, UN rights experts are also warning that pardons and amnesties, I'm quoting them, open doors for future abuses when states use the service of private military and security companies for inherent state functions. Do you share the same opinion?
Well, I've written that in some of my old reports to the Human Rights Council and to the General Assembly. Indeed, in the ontology of the state is to keep an army and to keep discipline in that army. The main problem with private security companies is that it's an attempt to outsource this ontological responsibility of the state. And there the so-called status of forces abroad agreements that essentially grant them total immunity in the countries where they're operating, in this case Iraq, on the assumption that if they commit a crime that they will be under in personam jurisdiction of United States courts, and that the military will actually investigate those allegations of war crimes, and that those responsible will be brought to justice. Well, here we have four individuals from Blackwater who were in fact brought to court and convicted back in 2014 for murder. It is a disgrace for a country under the rule of law that it would be tolerated that a crime as egregious as this one would be subject to pardoning. But as Mr. Trump said, these were people who had a long history of service to our nation, and therefore they deserve being pardoned. Now, this is like a mafia boss saying, well, they're my boys. You know, my boys are good boys. And that, when I was a young student in high school in Chicago, I mean, I remember the kind of daily indoctrination, if you want. You know, I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation under God, etc., etc., etc. What does that mean? Is that we are indoctrinated in believing that we, Americans, are, by definition, the good guys. We're always the good guys. Our soldiers do not commit war crimes. Our private military security officers do not commit war crimes. Only the other side commits war crimes. And that's why what we need is universal jurisdiction.
Right.
So that countries other than the United States, when an American official goes to, say, Switzerland, that if he is, say, the Minister of Defense, and he comes to Switzerland, well, he has responsibility for all the war crimes that have been committed under his jurisdiction,
right,
if he has not ensured accountability.
Mm-hmm.
So universal jurisdiction is a concept that has to be played in.
Right. Now, Ian, in a statement announcing this controversial pardons just a few days ago, the White House said that the move was broadly supported by the public and also backed by a number of Republican lawmakers. Is that really the case?
Well, I'm fairly sure it was backed by a large number of Republican lawmakers, because they're looking over their shoulders at the Trump supporters who will or won't vote for them. I mean, you know, if Adolf Hitler had the good sense to wear a GI's uniform, these people would all be supporting him, no problem. But on the other side, if they were putting when we're talking about the public, is the public aware of it? That's the real problem. And I think my colleague here was making the point, the public is not aware of most of this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
If you ask them about Milei, it's not on their list of battles. If you ask them about Abu Ghraib, if you ask them about Guantanamo, this is not big on the mental horizon. It's an issue that's buried very thoroughly. If it's brought up at all by the media, it's very likely, because the media has exactly the same prejudices. Our guys are right, the other side are wrong. If our guys are wrong now and again, then we should cut them some slack, because they're doing this for us after all. I mean, there is a cult of the uniform and the veteran here in the United States, which pervades everything. A veteran, I mean, you know, a veteran can do no wrong. In fact, lots of veterans do wrong. And, you know, the whole point of people in uniform is you're training them to go abroad and kill people.
Mm-hmm.
And they often do it, you know, excessively, and with too much zeal. And so people do feel sympathy for them. You know, I've spoken, everyone calls the Second World War the finest war. I've spoken to many veterans who tell horrifying stories about what happened to prisoners who fell into their hands if they were inconvenient. And but they're just ignored. People know about them, but the reality is obscured to preserve this overall vision that the United States is a city on a hill. And it's not just the United States, of course. Lots of other countries. The British have never held responsible those who committed atrocities in Kenya or in South Yemen or in India, come to think of it. The other places where they're involved. The French have never come to terms with Algeria. So, you know, it's not a uniquely American problem,
right,
but it is, because America is, the United States is the sort of founding partner of the United Nations, keeps upholding, keeps saying it's taking action to uphold international law. Its actions against Iran are wreathed in the obligations to under international law and order, and yet it completely flouts it whenever it suits them. And in this particular case, there were options. I mean, Donald Trump could have said, oh, well, look, these guys, they were young, they're in a terrible situation, so I'll exercise clemency. We'll commute their sentences. But he didn't. He said a pardon. And the pardon implies this is all right, that they are, in effect, judicially speaking, innocent.
Alfred, you both talked about, Ian talked about global jurisdiction. The ICC, ICJ, I mean, the U.S. does not recognize, you know, these international tribunals. So we have had a long record of the U.S. doing things, similar things since the Korea War, the things that the U.S. did in Afghanistan, you know, the U.N. probe about it and all that. So is there a remedy to this exceptionalism, U.S. forces always being good guys, infallible, great, you know, guys who never do anything wrong?
Well, it's up to us Americans to make sure that our fellow Americans, shall we say, grow up and realize that exceptionalism is not the way forward. But we still live in this bubble, and we still believe that we are the good guys. And it took me decades, actually, to separate myself from that, to, say, jump over my own shadow, to think outside the box. Not everybody does that. Here you are in your comfort zone. But while we're talking about universal jurisdiction, I mean, this can be done, and actually it has occurred. Back years ago, 2007 or 2008, when Donald Rumsfeld went to a right-wing group to speak in Paris, he had to escape because there was a warrant for his arrest. And he left Paris and he went into Germany and was flown back to the United States with a military plane. So you see that there is a possibility under international law to prosecute for war crimes, crimes against humanity, and under the Convention Against Torture, which the United States has ratified.
Right.
Under the Convention Against Torture, there is an obligation of the territorial state to arrest and try whatever person is within its jurisdiction, in its territory, like Donald Rumsfeld at that moment,
right,
who is accused of having committed torture. That is, not he personally, but he as the responsible minister whose soldiers committed torture in Guantanamo and elsewhere. Let me just say one point.
Okay, we have only a few seconds left.
Assange and Snowden, we demand absolutely, and we must demand as Americans, that the president grant pardon both to Julian Assange and to Edward Snowden, both of whom are human rights defenders.
Okay.
And they have done more for the world than many others, and I think that the campaign against Assange is disgraceful. My colleague Niels Meltzer, rapporteur on torture, has specifically written to Donald Trump and demanded a pardon for...
Okay, Alfred, unfortunately, that's all the time we have. We're out of time. Thank you very much for your comments. We had senior analyst with Foreign Policy and Focus, Ian Williams, out of New York, and former independent expert with the UN Human Rights Council, Alfred Desaias, out of Geneva. And your host, Behrouz Najafi.
This is IRIB English Radio. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Democrat Nancy Pelosi, the only female U.S. Speaker of the House of Representatives, has been narrowly re-elected to the position on Sunday, January 3rd, as a new Congress took office amid political uncertainty in the final days of Donald Trump's presidency. The 80-year-old lawmaker from California secured her fourth term as House Speaker by earning 216 votes versus 209 for Republican leader Kevin McCarthy. Her re-election comes as Senate control is undecided and a Republican fight looms over presidential election results. Democrats lost 11 seats in the November elections to command a narrower 222 to 212 majority. On Sunday, five fellow Democrats defected. Two voted for Democratic lawmakers who were not running, while three others simply voted present. Pelosi has been a fierce opponent of President Trump and his chief nemesis, saying last month that she wants to pull him out of White House by his hair, his little hands and feet. In this regard, we have prepared for you an article written by Nicholas Fandos under the heading, Pelosi Secures Another Term as U.S. House Speaker as Senate Hangs in Balance. This article was published by the New York Times. Please stay with us to hear more about this issue. Democrats returned Representative Nancy Pelosi of California to the House speakership on Sunday, January 3rd, for what may be her final term, handing a leader control of the slimmest majority in almost two decades as Washington prepares for a new Democratic president. The nearly party-line vote punctuated an opening day marked more by precaution than pomp, as the 117th Congress convened under the threat of a deadly pandemic and awaited a pair of Senate runoffs in Georgia that will determine control of that chamber. Several House members sick with COVID-19 missed the session altogether, and others cast their votes from behind the plexiglass enclosure, especially constructed in a gallery overlooking the chamber. Her victory means that after 2 years as President Donald Trump's most outspoken antagonist, Pelosi will now be responsible for trying to shepherd through Congress as much of President-elect Joseph R. Biden Jr.'s agenda as possible. She said in a speech after winning the speakership, "Scripture tells us that to everything there is a season, a time for every purpose under the heavens. A time to build, a time to sow, a time to heal." Adding, "Now is certainly a time for our nation to heal. Our most urgent priority will continue to be defeating the coronavirus and defeat it will. It will be no easy task, with her party in control of just 222 of 435 seats, Pelosi can afford to lose only a handful of Democrats on any given vote. Emboldened Republicans are gunning to retake the majority in next year's midterm elections and are in no mood to extend an olive branch. Representative Kevin McCarthy of California, the Republican leader, used his own remarks before presenting Pelosi the gavel to torch Democrats' record in the majority and effectively declared the beginning of the campaign to wrest power from them. He said, "It has been said that a House divided cannot stand," adding, "Well, if there is any lesson Americans have learned in the last 2 years, it's this. A House distracted cannot govern." Many of his members were preparing to use a normally perfunctory joint session of Congress on Wednesday, January 6th, to make one final futile attempt to overturn Biden's victory in key swing states and hand Donald Trump a second term based on claims of election fraud. The effort was destined to fail, but was certain to set a bitter tone for the year ahead. Pelosi secured 216 votes for Speaker on Sunday afternoon, January 3rd, keeping defections within her party to just a handful, despite grumbling from some moderates and progressives eager for new leadership. Only five lawmakers ultimately broke ranks. Representatives Mickey Sherrill of New Jersey, Alyssa Slotkin of Michigan, Abigail Spanberger of Virginia, Jared Golden of Maine, and Connor Lamb of Pennsylvania. Crucially, Pelosi won over several Democrats who had defected 2 years, including Ron Kind of Wisconsin, Jim Cooper of Tennessee, Kurt Schrader of Oregon, and Kathleen Rice of New York. Many said they took her at her word that this term would most likely be her last. Slotkin said in an interview, "It's not personal, it's not malicious, it just represents a feeling in my district that we need more Midwestern leaders and we need a different crop that represents a broader swath of the country." With both chambers narrowly divided, Slotkin urged Democratic leaders to set aside messaging bills that have no chance of becoming law in the coming term and try to make bipartisan compromises. Representative Don Young, Republican of Alaska and the longest-serving House member, made a similar appeal when he rose to administer the oath of office to Pelosi. Young said, "I will be honest. I do not like what I see," adding, "It's time we hold hands and talk to one another." He suggested the two sides ought to sit down, but Pelosi refused. On the other side of the Capitol, six new senators were sworn in, but both parties were more concerned with the runoff elections. The outcome could determine the fate of Biden's legislative goals on climate change, taxes, and health care, his response to the coronavirus pandemic, and his ability to fill his cabinet and influential federal judgeships. Republicans currently have an edge, with 51 seats on Democrats' 48. Democrats would have to sweep both races to draw the chamber to a tie and effectively take control when Vice President-elect Kamala Harris, who would cast tie-breaking votes when needed, is sworn in with Biden on January 20th. Senator Mitch McConnell, Republican of Kentucky, and the majority leader said in brief congratulatory remarks to say the 117th Congress convenes at a challenging time would indeed be an understatement, adding, from political division to a deadly pandemic to enemies around the world, the hurdles before us are many and they are serious. At least one, the pandemic made itself felt immediately inside the Capitol on Sunday. Brian P. Monahan, Congress attending physician, strongly encouraged lawmakers in a memo beforehand to refrain from gatherings of any kind in their office spaces and warned that any family members accompanying them could be asked to produce negative test results. Inside the House chamber, lawmakers took their oath of office and voted for Speaker in small groups, rather than all together in the normally boisterous hall of the House. At one point, aides had to press a newly elected Republican, Marjorie Taylor Greene of Georgia, to put on a mask as required under House rules, causing a minor stir. The architect of the Capitol even constructed a small plexiglass enclosure with its own ventilation system in one of the galleries overlooking the chamber so that three lawmakers in a protective quarantine could vote in person without mingling on the House floor. Two newly elected Republicans, Maria Elvira Salazar of Florida and David Valado of California, missed Sunday's swearing-in altogether because they were homesick with the virus. Third, Luke Letlow of Louisiana died last week of COVID-19 complications before he could be seated to the position he won in a December runoff. Gion Moore, Democrat of Wisconsin, arrived to cast her vote for Pelosi fresh off her own isolation, less than a week after she announced she had tested positive. Representative John Katko, a New York Republican who just won re-election in a Democratic leading district, said, "It's somber for sure." Katko said he drove to Washington alone on Sunday morning without the company of his family who would normally come for a large celebration. Republicans swore in 17 new women in the House, more than doubling their numbers from 116 Congress and setting a new high water mark for the party and for the number of women in the House. 122, 2 years after Democrats swept into power with their own historically diverse cohort. Marking the achievement on the chamber floor, Representative Liz Cheney, the highest-ranking Republican woman, claimed, "Republican women are here to work. They are here to get things done," adding, "As we like to say in Wyoming, it is time to cowgirl up." Pelosi has been a fierce opponent of President Trump and his chief nemesis, saying last month that she wants to pull him out of the White House by his hair, his little hands and feet. Pelosi told her leadership team, "I'm counting down the hours till he's gone." The two clashed bitterly over the past 2 years, particularly as she leveled impeachment charges against the president. Trump was impeached in December 2019 for abuse of power and obstruction of Congress charges, but the Senate acquitted him early in 2020. In Sunday's vote, among those who initially opposed Pelosi, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, one of the most high-profile Democrats in Washington, and incoming lawmaker Cori Bush, who is the first African-American woman to represent Missouri in Congress. Ocasio-Cortez said, "We are just an extremely slim amount of votes away from risking the speakership to the Republican Party."
Good morning.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.